they saw was a man from the giant Texas land. He put the Chamber of Commerce on a limb. They voted him the best, and the government did no less, till the IOUs of Texas fell on him. Stand tall, Billy Saul, we don't know you at all. We've taken down your pictures from the wall. Well, we don't want to handle an agriculture scandal. We have got to face elections in the fall. Oh, I remember when Bill had influential friends. He celebrated Christmas every day. He built several Texas banks with his fertilizer tanks. Influential friends don't die, they only fade away. Stand tall, Billy Saul, we don't know you at all. We've taken down your pictures from the wall. Well, we don't want to handle an agriculture scandal. We have got to face elections in the fall. The Democrats denied, and Orville Freeman sighed. He said everyone around was fair and square. But he was no more convincing than Ezra Taft Benson, as resignations cropped up everywhere. Stand tall, Billy Saul, we don't know you at all. We've taken down your pictures from the wall. Well, we don't want to handle an agriculture scandal. We have got to face elections in the fall. And now I'd like to say that crime sure doesn't pay. But if you want to make some money on the sly, well, you can always rent the U.S. government. It's the best one that money can buy. Stand tall, Billy Saul, we don't know you at all. We've taken down your pictures from the wall. Well, we don't want to handle an agriculture scandal. We have got to face elections in the fall.
Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Insurgent Radio Network calling, and this is Tom Metzger, otherwise known as Terrible Tommy, right here in the bunker, right here in the Robert J. Matthews Memorial Bunker. That's right beside our Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse filling station, and the world-renowned Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where we bring them in here, plug up the holes, bondo them all up, sand them down, give them a paint job, and you come on down here in your 18-wheelers in the summertime, pick them up, take them on back, and get ready for whatever invasion you're getting ready to do, man. I'll tell you, I begin to worry about the price of this stuff that I've been paying real cheap, because it's all over the place, you know, all over Hell's Half Acre, cheap. But if they get to going over there in Ukraine and they get to spend some more money, well, then that equipment's going to cost us a lot more money. So we hope that don't happen. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the radio show, your daily radio show, and other projects you'd like to send a donation for. I just sent a subscription to Mother Jones, to our friend Richard Scutari down there in Louisiana. And also I got word that Matt Hale's pretty happy with the books we've been sending him and so forth, too. So anyhow, everybody seems to be pretty happy. Our Lone Wolves requested this song, Ode to Billy Saul. And I got to thinking right away, is that the old Billy Saul I used to know? Because that was back in my day when I was right in there with the, what there used to be, a conservative Republicans, you know, way back when Barry Goldwater was around and so forth. But I knew all about Billy Saul. So did my main squeeze, because she's from Texas. But all you have to do is pick up the book, A Texan Looks at Lyndon, which was distributed quite heavily during the Goldwater-Johnson campaign. And if people would have taken it to heart, they wouldn't have voted for that crooked-ass Johnson. But anyhow, Billy Saul Estes was a He was a fast mover, shaker, fraud kind of guy that was making all kinds of money. And he was selling these fertilizer tanks all over Texas. And I forget exactly how the scam worked, but they caught up with him and they brought him down. But before they brought him down there, I remember they had a federal investigator, or maybe it was a state investigator. I doubt it, because Texas politics was always crooked as hell. Anyhow, the investigator went out to investigate this this fraud on the people of Texas and the government of Texas. Was shot in the back several times, and he obviously was dead. And they declared it down there in Texas suicide. He was shot in the back with a rifle several times, and they declared it suicide. So you get an idea about how rotten the Billy Saul Estes people. There was another guy who was connected with him in Washington, too, with Johnson. I'm trying to remember his name that was big in the news all the time, and he got caught with his hand in a cookie jar, too. But as far as I'm concerned, the whole Johnson administration was so corrupt, it was unbelievable. But in reality, they're all pretty corrupt as far as that goes. But anyhow, that's the ode to Billy Saul. I got that Texan Looks at Linden around in used bookstore. You can probably buy it for a quarter. You ought to read it about how crooked Johnson was. Johnson should have been in federal penitentiary instead of running for president. He broke every law in the book down there, including murder, and also his ballot box stuffing in Duval County. Duval County is what got him elected senator. He beat Coke Stevens, who evidently was a pretty honest guy, but he couldn't stand up to the crookedness of Johnson. And Johnson's right-hand man, who was charged with murder in Texas, but Johnson got him out of it. According to one of the stories I've got, they found his fingerprint on the windowsill at the Texas Book Depository, where Lee Harvey Oswald was supposed to have killed Kennedy. They found his fingerprint there, but it never went any farther than that. So one of the foremost fingerprint experts in the United States checked that out. And I think he was there. And if he was, it's very interesting, his connection to Johnson. That was back in the day when there were some conservatives around. And they were pretty strong, too. Not strong enough to override the corruption, but they were. These people who call themselves conservatives today are a joke. These are not conservatives. These neocons and all these people, they're no more a conservative than the man in the moon. Well, I'm going to bring you a little bit of information about the very, very rich, the pampered and the delusional rich. Here on our whimsical island off the coast of Eastern Seaboard, we have a company called Manhattan Mini Storage that is as famous for the semi-snarky wit of its billboards and subway posters as it is for the spaces it rents to us New Yorkers who live in apartments so small the mice are stoop-shouldered. The sacrifice we make for living here is that we have no room for all our stuff. This storage facility exists to bridge the gap by renting out urban equivalent of an attic or a cellar where we can stash our junk until our next move, new relationship, or death. Some of its advertising addresses this problem directly. Quote, "Your closet's tinier than a runaway model's lunch," unquote, one read a couple of years ago. Quote, "When he's a keeper, but his stuff isn't," unquote, was another favorite. Yet most of the notoriety the firm's ads have achieved has little to do with their product and as much to do with pride of places and politics. Quote, New York City, tolerant of your beliefs, judgment of your shoes, unquote, is a New York state of mind that even those who favor sneakers and loafers over Louboutins can get behind. Others are more candidate-specific. Quote, Rick Perry, the voice in our head that is not God, said what a lot of us were thinking, and if, quote, if Mitt had storage, he'd be able to find his tax returns, unquote. Actually does manage to deftly combine product placement with a point of view, but their current ad really catches the eye. Quote, the French aristocracy never saw it coming either, unquote. It, of course, is a revolt of the 99%, the thought of which seems to have elements of the 1% so freaked out they can barely choke down their salon blanc de blanc. But apparently, whenever the American elite contemplates the possibility of open rebellion against income inequality, it's not peasants storming the Bastille at the start of the French Revolution that they see. It's Nazis jackbooting into mansions and searching the premises for yacht owners. How else to explain venture capitalist Tom Perkins' infamous comparison of what he called progressive war to Kristallnacht? And now we have Home Depot tycoon Ken Langdon telling Politico.com that as far as popular sentiment goes, quote, I hope it's not working, because if you go back to 33 with different words, this is what Hitler was saying in Germany. You don't survive as a society if you encourage and thrive on envy or jealousy. Langdon, or Langon, subsequently has apologized, sort of. So did Perkins, sort of. But the foul deed is done. The smear is smeared, and it won't be the last time this particular straw dog barks, because a lot of the time it works. Nor will his envy and jealousy mime disappear anytime soon, because it too seems to have captured the imagination of the plutocracy. Quote, it's safe to conclude that a national shift towards envy would be toxic for American culture, unquote, Arthur C. Brooks, president of the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, wrote in March, the second edition of the New York Times. Indeed, such envy might do just that, but beyond internet trolls and covetous cranks, where is it? The headline of Jonathan Chait's recent story in the New York Magazine notes vast public envy, an imaginary epidemic. The closest we have come politically, he writes, quote, was a brief upsurge in populist anger for a short period in 2009 following news reports of bonuses handed out to employees at bailed out recipient AIG. The House of Representatives, by a vote of 328-93, passed a 90% tax on those bonuses. But the Obama administration opposed the bill, and the Senate forgot about it, and the moment passed. It's notable that even this small, ultimately ineffectual moment did not rise from any generalized spate of envy, but specific resentment against the use of tax dollars to reward failure. What's handy about making accusations of envy or jealousy is that it doesn't have to reflect badly on you, the accuser. Hey, it can't be helped if people are resentful. Your success is your own, and why should there be apologies for making something of yourself? Thus, victimhood becomes the wine devour du jour of the super rich. It goes well with everything. Quote, the politics of envy are the wrong politics in America, Wall Street shill and former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers proclaimed in Politico. Quote, the better politics are the politics of inclusion, where everyone shares in economic growth. There it is, the sound of another shoe dropping, because the second half of the argument goes that instead of being jealous, We all should be working in harmony together to create jobs and opportunity. Problem is that the deeply rich talk about building the economy but do almost nothing about it. There's a lot of take and a lot of keep, but not much giving back. Open the Books, a new nonprofit working for greater transparency in government spending, reports that between 2000 and 2012, Fortune magazine's top 100 companies received $1.2 trillion from the feds. And Aaron Cantu writes in the alternet.org that doesn't include all the billions of dollars doled out to housing, auto, banking enterprises in 2008 and 2009. Nor does it include ethanol subsidies and agribusiness or tax breaks for wind turbine generators. Investigative journalist David K. Johnson reports big business hoarding money as if they were hiding cash in a mattress. Quote, Uncle Sam spent $3.5 trillion in fiscal 2013. Corporations hold liquid assets equal to all the money the federal government spent that year, plus 2012 and 3 months of 2011. The total corporate cash reserve, the amount to almost $25,000 per American, up from $13,000 per American in 1994. Again, after the adjusting for inflation. And this cash is highly concentrated, most of it held by 2,800 biggest companies, the IRS data shows. Since 1994, liquid assets have grown at about 6 times sales. My analysis of official data shows when liquid assets grow 6 times faster than revenue, it tells you the companies are hoarding cash, not investing or spending. Richard Rubin of Bloomberg News recently found that the largest U.S.-based companies added $206 billion to their stockpiles of offshore profits last year, parking earnings in low-tax countries until Congress gives them a reason not to. The multinational companies have accumulated $1.95 trillion outside the U.S., up 11.8% from the year earlier. Alan Pike at the website Think Progress adds, quote, while precise estimates of lost revenue are difficult to make, previous inquiries into profit offshoring found that it cost the U.S. between $30 billion and $90 billion each year during the early and middle 2000, when the pile of untaxed corporate profits was much smaller. States and localities also lose out on tens of billions of dollars in tax revenue each year to similar offshore strategies. A recent study found that by closing just one small loophole in state business tax laws, states could bring in $1 billion in new revenue almost overnight. Think of the highways, bridges, and housing that money could build or repair, and the jobs that could be created, the teachers and the tuition it could provide, the mouths it could feed. Then throw in corporate malfeasance without punishment, gross management, and exorbitant executive salaries. For example, Henrique DeCastro, the failed number two at Yahoo, who's getting $109 million for his 15 disastrous months there, or about $244,000 per day. Anger about these salient facts is simply common sense, and income inequality is all too real. But we're not jealous or anti-money, as Mark Twain wrote, quote, I'm opposed to millionaires, but it would be dangerous to offer me the position. So try to change your tune, plutocrats. Contrary to your fantasies, we are plagued by reality, not envy. Unless you live here in Manhattan and have a lot of closet space, then we need to talk. That's a pretty good one. I like that. Laughable to hear billionaires crying about how we serfs are picking on them because they're stealing too much money. Well, I understand on the 28th, the judge up there in North Dakota is going to decide on what's going to happen with Craig Cobb. Being somewhat of a pessimist, as you probably recognize, and somewhat of a cynic, which you probably recognize, or anybody that goes along with Murphy's Law, if anything can go wrong, it will. I would suspect that that judge may work with the Canadian government to kidnap Craig Cobb, take him back to Canada, and make him go through a trial for a so-called hate crime that would never be a hate crime down here. Had no violence at all involved. It was strictly free speech. But if that judge pulls that, that's going to show you that there are higher ups involved in this thing. Way higher ups. Just to sort of make a target out of Craig Cobb for no more than he did, which he actually did nothing that should have even been charged in the first place. I would charge him for being not using all his neurons in his brain. We're making some mistakes there, but for a crime, there was no crime went on there. So on the 28th, we're going to find out about that. I would suggest they get Craig Cobb out of the state because I don't know whether Craig is appealing to his Norse gods of Odin and Thor, but North Dakota, if you'll check on the news up there, they're having one problem after another. And they've had train wrecks and big oil spills and all kinds of crap going on up there. And it really a lot of nasty stuff. Plus, probably all the fat cats up there are going to vote for this Keystone Pipeline, which is going to be a big, really, really bad thing because of its effect on ecology and the fact that it doesn't make you or I or anybody in North Dakota any money at all. They're going to hire a few jobs for a few months till it's built. And then they'll have a skeleton crew to be checking on it, and they'll have to be checking on it all the time because it's only got a one wall. It's not double walled, and they project it'll have a 1-2% leakage anyhow, but you can imagine what could happen if those big pipes with all that dirty oil get broken. And like they've had some already broken, one up in Canada and like that. So I don't know, maybe Craig is bringing karma down on the state of North Dakota. I guess we'll have to see what happens. Say though that if they do extradite him somehow back to Canada, the jails are much better in Canada than they are down here. My son and I, John, were in the Don jail in Toronto for a few days. We were treated quite well, including tea and crumpets every day, about 10 o'clock in the morning and about 3 in the afternoon. And the people, the guards at that jail are civil servants, and they're very well trained and they're very polite. Evidently, speaking of my son John, he just had a very pleasant day with Randy Evans, socializing and having a barbecue. Randy Evans, of course, was a member of the order, and he did, what did he do? About 20 years. Yeah, so anyhow, John was able, and their families get together and have a good time. As I told you before, the death of Jeremy Reinemann happened last week, and but they want to have, the family just wants a very private gathering in the home of the mother, and they don't want a bunch of people coming, so I'm not going to advertise where it's going to be. Suppose you all notice how many times They'll move heaven and earth to prove a black man innocent who's been in prison for 30, 40 years. I see nothing wrong with an innocent man being released from prison. But the progressives, the liberals in this country, go overboard to where they concentrate on black prisoners. And very, very few times do they go all the way to get a white man out of prison. So they're always bragging about how they get a black man freed. And I sometimes question these situations that were they really innocent or not, because you're dealing with evidence that's 20, 30, 40 years old, and witnesses die and so forth. And I'm suspect of a lot of this stuff. Now here's a sample of that, what I'm talking about. Glenn Ford, a Louisiana native, walked out of the state penitentiary in Angola. Incidentally, Angola is really worse than the gulags in Russia. A free man after being on death row more than 30 years for a crime he did not commit. When asked by a CNN reporter, "How much of your life did you lose?" Ford replied, "30 years of my life, if not all of it. I can't go back. My sons, when I left, were babies. Now they're grown men with babies." Ford was convicted of first-degree murder and robbery by an all-white jury. Well, obviously. For killing of Isidore Roseman. I wonder if he was a Jew. Isidore Roseman? Maybe that's why they hammered a black guy. A 56-year-old watchmaker from Shreveport. Roseman was found shot to death behind the counter of his shop. Ford did occasionally do yard work for Roseman. Yeah, this guy, Isidore Roseman's a Jew. "We are very pleased to see Glenn Ford finally exonerated, and we are particularly grateful that the prosecution and the court moved ahead so decisively to set Mr. Ford free," said Ford's attorneys, Gary Clements and Aaron Novod, from the Capitol Post-Conviction of Project in Louisiana. For three decades, Ford's now 63, has maintained his innocence as he filed multiple appeals. Most of them were denied. Well, hey, get to the end of the line, buddy. All our white guys, all my white friends, they keep putting in appeals like Matt Hale. It never goes anywhere. Because no judge, state or federal, wants to admit that another judge has made mistakes. This is interesting. Though the specifics regarding the evidence that warranted his release are unclear, it is known that in 2000, the Supreme Court of Louisiana ordered an evidentiary hearing based on Ford's claim that the prosecution withheld evidence that implicated Jake and Henry Robinson, two brothers initially suspected of committing the crime. Well, how do we know that all three of them were involved in killing the Jew? They're very, very shady, this so-called exculpatory evidence. Ford's defense attorneys argue that his trial was compromised by the unconstitutional suppression of evidence and by inexperienced counsel. That doesn't mean he was innocent. Just because he didn't have the greatest lawyer doesn't mean he's innocent. I'd like to see the evidence on a table where I could look it over. The Shreveport Times reports that court records show prosecutors received credible evidence in 2013 that supported a finding that Ford was neither present at nor a participant in the robbery and the murder of Isidore Roseman. Well, you know, he got the family. The family said, "Oh, no, he was with me that night. We were playing pool." Oh, okay, well, we'll get him out then. The paper also suggests an unidentified informant told prosecutors that Jake Robinson admitted to shooting and killing Roseman that same year. Well, how come he wasn't arrested? He was another black guy. Ford, who had upheld on death row since March 85, is Louisiana's longest-serving death row prisoner and one of the longest-serving prisoners in the entire country. He was sentenced to die in the electric chair. Well, anyhow, in a statement read shortly before his release, Tenawa Tamilia McHarris, those are African names, senior campaigner for Amnesty International USA, said, Glenn Ford is living proof of just how flawed our system truly is. Well, it is flawed, but how come it leans towards getting blacks out of prison and not whites? We are moved that Mr. Ford, an African-American man convicted by an all-white jury, will be able to leave death row a survivor. Well, anyhow, I'm suspect of these kind of deals because they put pressure on these governors and DAs and attorney generals after the fact, after many decades. They say, look, let's just let him out and get rid of it. Well, I hope he sues the goddamn state for $10 million and gets it. Maybe I can get a job driving his limo. Well, I bet you didn't hear about this one. According to a Republican South Dakota state senator and free market economy advocate, businesses should have the right to deny services to clientele based on their race. In an interview with the Rapid City Journal, Phil Jensen stood by those beliefs, saying if someone was a member of the Ku Klux Klan and they were running a little bakery, for instance, the majority of us would find it detestable that they refused to serve blacks. I wouldn't. And guess what? In a matter of weeks or so, that business would be shut down because no one would be going to patronize them. Well, that's what you think. They might be overwhelmed with business. Jensen believes that the free market should... this is one of these Chicago economist types. Jensen believes that the free market should decide whether or not racial discrimination is acceptable, not the government. Well, racial discrimination should be totally, naturally legal, period. Not depending on the market at all. These views are in line with the Bill Jensen, with a bill Jensen pushed in the South Dakota last legislative session, Senate Bill 128, which proposed legalized discrimination by encouraging employers to enforce the right to refuse service based on a customer's sexual orientation without fear of a lawsuit. Well, this guy's probably a Bible beater. He should do it on the basis of race. Let's get it out in the open. It's a bill that protects the constitutional right of free association, the right of free speech, and the private property rights, Jensen said in SB 128. A bill that would have ensured freedom of business to choose their clientele, unquote. Well, the problem here is they used this same thing on me when I won the Democratic nomination for Congress back in 1980. The Democrat Party went to court and said that under the 14th Amendment, it would be involuntary servitude for them to be forced to let me into their official meetings and so forth. So they barred me from their businesses. Now, if I'd have been a nigger, of course, that never could have happened in 100 years. So you got to watch this kind of stuff. The bill failed by a 5-2 vote. So, it'd be interesting to see it go a little farther, though, just for the hell of it. I don't know whether I told you about this, but on this race-mixing webpage, they have, they were talking about Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin, and the argument was over, was it a white-on-black crime? A reader commented, very, very tragic situation. They should have arrested Zimmerman. I can understand the outrage. I don't understand the perception that this is a white-on-black crime. obviously, because Zimmerman's not white. Well, this is the convoluted thinking of the race mixers. Thank you for sensitively expressing your desire for understanding. Asking is the first step towards gaining clarity. Asking with care builds bridges. This is absolutely about white on black. Please read my original column about Trayvon Martin to see my full explanation on stand your ground laws. Not understanding about this is not being a white on black crime is related to white privilege. White people can look at Trayvon's murder as a horrible incident in isolation. We white people do have to live under the context of a pattern of injustice. In other words, a typical Marxist thing to spread the guilt all around to everybody. We cannot see the forest, we just see the trees. Most white people have no awareness of white privilege. Oh, they don't? We read these magazines, the Fortune 500. We know about that white privilege, but not the working class white privilege. And it says, even if they do, it's impossible to truly understand it from the perspective of being an outsider. Oh, boy. The logic these guys use. There's a mechanical legal reason for not arresting Zimmerman, but it's part of a pattern. The white police chief didn't arrest Zimmerman because the police chief and the prosecutor don't do things that ruin their arrest prosecution percentages. Every state that passed the Stand Your Ground law has the same problem. Judges can dismiss a case before the trial begins under the concept of true immunity based on the Stand Your Ground assertion. Well, that's true. That's the way the law is written. And I know how cops think, and I know how DAs think. The legal situation before the National Rifle Association started advocating the Stand Your Ground law and got it passed in 21 states was that an armed person was expected to back down from a confrontation. The combination of shall issue and stand your ground equates to legalized lynching because there are too many guys like Zimmerman packing pistols. So, using this logic, if there were no white people around, but just a very tiny 1% left in the country, they still would all be guilty of black-on-white crime if anything happened, an attack. In other words, even with hardly any whites around, you'd still be benefiting by white privilege. And I'll tell you, man, I've been benefiting by white privilege for a long time. Shit. I can't hardly stand it. I get so much. A guy wrote in and asked this magazine, I'm white and I'm from Africa. Why am I not an African American? Well, the race mixer answers this way. Yes and no. I acknowledge that you posted your comment with positive sincerity. However, I agree with your first point, but not the second. African American refers to descendants of enslaved black people who are from the United States. I don't think that's ever been proven or written down. Where did that come from? The reason we use an entire continent, Africa, instead of the country, is because slave masters purposely obliterated tribal language, tribal ancestry, and family units in order to destroy the spirit of the people they enslaved, thereby making it impossible for their descendants to trace their history prior to being born into slavery. No, they did it because they wanted to have the best slave, just like the best horses and everything else, in the right places. If you were a very rich plantation owner and you could afford the very strongest and the best, and you didn't want the wife and the kids to come along, well, they'd split them up. That's just a fact of life. Now, they say this was all in an effort to prevent enslaved people from organizing and revolting their bondage. No. No, it wasn't. If anything, it might have made it more likely because of concentrating the best physical specimens of slaves in one particular plantation where they could have conspired to rise up. Enforcing illiteracy of enslaved people by law with severe penalties, including death in some cases, for teaching an enslaved person to write. Well, if you're a slave supporter, that's, of course, a logical thing for you to do. I won't argue about it. And obliterating any sense of history of family ties with the tradition. Well, this goes on and on and on, but it skirts the real issue. If you're from Africa and you're white, you should be called, if you want to, I can see where most people wouldn't want to be, because we've got tens of thousands, maybe millions of white South Africans have bailed out of that pest hole, come to the United States, and they probably don't want to be called African Americans, but they certainly should if they want to. There's a little bit of that black exceptionalism they keep criticizing whites for. World Jewry, or at least a substantial portion of it, has declared war on Russia. Jewish-controlled media, from New York Times to the Washington Post to Tablet Magazine, an Israeli magazine, have all launched vitriolic attacks against Vladimir Putin. The sole exception seems to be the Jewish Daily Forward, normally a voice of reason within the universe of Jewish-owned media, which appears to be holding to a policy of editorial neutrality on the issue. Well, you know, there were thousands and thousands of Russians who were integrated highly into the Russian people, the Slavic people, moved to Israel and got out from under communism. And also a lot of those people actually became so-called neo-Nazis down there in Israel, and it's an embarrassment to the Israeli government. Now, if they push this anti-Russian thing real hard in Israel, I think you're going to see a lot of these people who are reasonably recent immigrants to Israel from Russia come down on the side of Russia, which I don't think Israel needs that kind of problems right now, but I don't think they're thinking this over too well. Looking at media voices outside the sphere of Jewish control provides striking contrast. Asia Times, Press TV, Times of India, and Xinhua's China, I guess, among others, have published articles critical of Western interference in Ukraine's internal affairs, challenging the U.S. overthrow of a democratically elected government, in many cases defending Russia. Jews, it should be remembered, voiced overwhelming approval at the overthrow of the Viktor Yanukovych, the deposed Ukrainian president, while some Jews, including former members of the Israeli military, even participated in the Maidan protests. This despite the presence of neo-Nazi elements among the opposition. Meanwhile, Western governments, uniformly pro-Israel in their policies, have begun targeting Russian officials with economic sanctions. What is the explanation for it all? What, if anything, does the Ukraine have to do with Israel? Why do so many Jews seem to be moving almost as if in lockstep on this issue? Is all this Zionist kvetching motivated solely by a Russian land grab of the Crimea, or is there something else at stake? A couple of interesting points were made recently by Soraya Sepor Ulrich, and which are worth recounting here. One is that Israel stands to benefit quite handsomely should sanctions block the sale of Russian natural gas to Europe. Israel has several offshore gas fields, as shown on the map below, one alone, the Tamar field is believed to contain about 275 billion cubic meters of gas, equivalent to about half of what Europe consumes annually, while another, the Leviathan field, is even larger. She also cites the recent comments of Gideon Tabor, CEO of Avner Oil, a subsidiary of Israeli-owned Delek Group, made at a March conference in Tel Aviv. His remarks were quite illuminating. Quote, with the recent events in Europe and the aspirations of different countries to diversify their gas supply, that puts another spotlight on our massive resources and transforms our story into a global one, he said. So you can see that thinking with the pocketbook, that seems to be a pretty big habit with Jews, but of course others too. So we'll see how that turns out. But it's going to be interesting to see whether there's any pushback from Russian Jews or Russians who claim they're Jews that immigrated into Israel over this anti-Russian push. Now I have my own little story to tell you. I told you yesterday that last evening they had a Holocaust so-called lady that was speaking here in the general area near the college, of course. But she was actually speaking at a big amphitheater that is underwritten by a big medical splint company. And so I said, well, I'll go out and see what she's got to say, because she says that she was actually experimented on, her and her sister, by Dr. Mengele, which I think may have been used to jazz up her performance. And the fact that she's alive is after being in the experiments by Dr. Mengele, that's a questionable situation. But anyhow, and I thought I might be able to get a question in, you know, like how many, what's the estimates of the number of bodies that were cremated in all the crematoriums in the camps, to get sort of a numerical baseline for figuring it out at roughly seven hours at the time, state of the art, to cremate a body. And I think you come up with some pretty strong figures. Obviously, there weren't 6 million people, even if there weren't 6 million people that were put in ovens, their dead bodies. But even with half of that amount, it comes up to decades that it would take to get it done. Anyhow, so I get in my car with my little camera and my tape recorder, and away I go. And I get within about a little over a mile from the meeting hall, and there's still about a half an hour to go before the meeting starts, and the roads were jam-packed. We don't have jam-packed roads around this small town. I mean, it's not a really teeny tiny town, but we don't have jammed roads. It gets a little heavy around quitting time around here for some of the factories. But nothing like this. It was solid. And they were coming on by the dozens behind me. And I said, wow, I'm getting out of here. So I did a U-ey and got out of there. But what it makes clear to you is, see, this is a Christ insanity-soaked area. Of course, the whole Midwest is, you know, except in the big cities. And so you can imagine, this is the power and the influence these Jews have got over these Christian Zionists. Because they had several articles in the paper about this is going to happen. And then they had a couple of more people come to town that they lived in Germany during the war and how horrible it was and all this kind of stuff. I don't know. I'd hate to be so arrogant as to think just because little old me's here that they brought in all these big guns like I'm standing out in front of grade schools trying to get kids into brown shirts I mean, it's sort of weird, though, I'll say that. So anyhow, there's that auditorium held 2,500 people, and I'll bet you there was a lot more than that showed up that couldn't even get in. See, that's why I keep saying that when the crap hits the fan, you're going to have to worry about these people probably more than blacks, because the blacks are not concentrated around places like this. They're in Chicago, a place like that. They may be burning down the town in Chicago or Cleveland or Detroit like that. But around here, these people are so pro-Israel that, you know, I told you, I've had them tell me they'd die for Israel. They have more, I've had them tell me they have more allegiance to Israel than they do for the United States. And that's all Christian stuff. So they become even more aggressive Jews than the Jews themselves, because there's probably only, there couldn't be more than 50 Jews in this town, probably less, unless I'm sadly mistaken. But nothing to cause this much of a commotion by people flocking by the hundreds and thousands to hear this gal give her pitch. Anyhow, it was it'll be all in the papers now for a few days, and everybody writing the papers will be seeing how wonderful it was, and to hear her talk, and she's such a wonderful hero woman, and all that kind of stuff. So that's the way it goes, boys and girls. That is the state of the Bible Belt. And like the Bible itself says, you can't serve two masters. If you think you're going to be friends with the Christian Zionists and be friends of the racial separatist struggle, it isn't going to work. It won't work. Well, a Belgium newspaper, De Morgan, has apologized for depicting President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama as apes on their cover after coming under fire over the weekend.
Share even more.
Wow. Well, a Kenyan woman who claims a man raped and infected her with HIV at a party recently admitted to sleeping with more than 300 men in revenge, the Kenyan Daily Post reports. Greensboro, North Carolina, Dargan Frierson, who in his career as an FBI agent kept watch on local Ku Klux Klan, died Saturday. He was 92. His story was chronicled in a news and record multimedia project in 2007 by former staff writer Jim Schlosser and photographed Jerry Wolford, and in a 2011 documentary produced by his son Michael Ferrison entitled FBI KKK. Quote, "It was a tough assignment," unquote, his eldest son, Dargan Frierson Jr., said during an interview Monday about his father's work. "I remember him getting calls in the middle of the night, having to drive down to eastern part of the state where they had a bombing. But he did it every day, put in those extra hours. He was a hardworking agent. He was courageous. He was a great father and a grandfather." A native of Sumter County, South Carolina, Frierson served as a flight trainer during World War II. Probably to train guys on how to bomb white civilians in Germany, and was inspired to join the FBI after hearing a speech by Melvin Purvis, the agent most famous for leading the manhunt against bank robber John Dillinger. Frierson joined the Bureau in 47, working first in Cleveland and Detroit, and moving to Greensboro in 51. So he was a Yankee transplant. Eventually, he worked full-time investigating the racial situation in the area. "I was taken off everything else and worked on nothing but developing informants," he said in FBI KKK. Among the informants he recruited was George Dorsett, CLUD or chaplain for the United Klans of America. Frierson originally was ambivalent about the civil rights movement, and in recruiting informants, he would note that his grandfather was in the early form of the Klan and had owned 144 slaves. In the documentary, Michael Frierson said his father would tell potential informants that, quote, "there's nothing illegal about belonging to the Klan," unquote. The goal was to, quote, "nail the deal down and get informants to take some money and sign a receipt, at which point you had them." Yep. According to the story, the News and Record story of 2007, Frierson first ran across Dorset in 1957 outside the Gillespie Park Elementary School, which was being integrated. Frierson tried several times to recruit Dorset before he agreed to provide information. Mainly, the two wanted to prevent the sort of violence that was going on elsewhere in the South. Yes, right. According to the article, Frierson was able to get Dorset to stop burning a church in Burlington. On another occasion, Dorset told an Alabama man with a truck full of landmines to leave the area. "He helped me a lot keeping down trouble," Frierson was quoted as saying. He would draw criticism not for preventing Dorset from continuing to burn crosses and harassing neighbors in Trogdon Street, but Dargon Frierson Jr. said his father always felt that he was able to contain Dorset. At times he was frustrated by these informants, Dargon Frierson Jr. said. "Even though George did these crazy things, they were trying to work together to stop the Klan from violence, and he, Dorset, still had to maintain enough of his persona to not be found out by his fellow Klansmen." Dorset was forced out as CLUD of the United Klans of America in 67 after he accused the group's leader, which was Robert Shelton, of financial impropriety. He founded a separate group with funding from the FBI, which sought to use a new organization to debilitate the United Klans of America. In 1975, he was exposed as an FBI informant by someone working for the Senate Intelligence Committee. Cool. Frierson retired from the FBI in 71 and went to work for the state's community college system, Burlington Industries, and Dillard Paper Company, the corporations. He also served a term as Greensboro City Council in the 70s. Dorset died in 2008 and remained an unrepentant racist until the end. Not a very good racist as an informant. But Frierson, his sons noted, changed his thinking as time went on, according to the FBI KKK. His wife, Josephine, who died in 2003, was a supporter of integration and helped sway him. His investigations also made inequality visible and concrete for him. In 2008, he voted for Barack Obama. Well, anyhow, that's enough of that. But here's a guy who thought he was still being a good racist, still acting as an informant. Unbelievable. And that's it for today, boys and girls. We'll be back with you tomorrow on, Thursday. Yeah, we'll be back with you tomorrow. Because this is Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day, 14-5. We need more evidence on whether Michelle is really Michael, a man.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds if we're together? Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather. Trails to you, till we meet again.
18.5.